the virals, and obviously something was happening. It appeared that they wanted people alive. Should they go back and warn the others? And Masami, even if her leg was all right, could she really continue on foot? They had no vehicles and very little in the way of ammunition for the weapons they possessed. They could probably find food on the way, but this would slow them down, and soon they would be entering the mountains, where the terrain would be more difficult. Could they expect a pregnant woman to walk all the way to Colorado? He was only posing these questions, Hollis said, because someone had to. He wasn't sure what he thought. On the other hand, they had come a long way. Babcock, whatever he was still out there, as were the many. Turning around brought risks of its own. Sitting on the ground outside the engine, the seven of them, Theo was still sleeping in the train, discussed their options. For the first time since they'd left, Peter sensed uncertainty among the group. The bunker and its bounty of supplies had given them a sense of security. A false one, maybe, but adequate to propel them forward. Now, stripped of their weapons and vehicles, with no food but what they could find, and having been cast 400 kilometers into an unknown wilderness, the idea of Colorado had become much more tenuous. The events at the Haven had left them all shaken. Never had it occurred to them that they would have to count among their obstacles the other human survivors they might encounter, or that a being like Babcock, a viral, but also something far more, possessing a power to control the others, could exist. Alicia, unsurprisingly, said she wanted to press on, as did Masami. If only, Peter thought, to prove that Alicia was no tougher than she was. Caleb said he would do whatever the group wanted to do, but as he voiced these words, his eyes were fixed on Alicia. If it came to a vote, Caleb would side with her. Michael also spoke for continuing, reminding everyone of the colony's failing batteries. "That's what this all comes down to," he said. As far as he was concerned, the message from Colorado was the only real hope they had, especially now, after what they'd seen at the Haven. This left Hollis and Sarah. Hollis plainly believed they should turn back. That he had come short of actually saying so, however, suggested that he believed, as Peter did, that the decision had to be unanimous. Sitting beside him in the shade of the train, her legs folded under her, Sarah appeared more uncertain. She was squinting across the field, where Amy was continuing her solitary vigil in the grass. Peter realized it had been many hours since he'd heard her voice.
"I remember some of it now," Sarah said after a moment. "When the viral took me. Bits and pieces, anyway."
She lifted her shoulders in a gesture that was half shrug, half shudder, and Peter knew she would say no more about this.
"Hollis isn't wrong. And I don't care what you say, Mouse, you're in no shape to be out here. But I agree with Michael.
If you're asking for my vote, Peter, that's it. So we keep going." She shifted her eyes toward Hollis, who nodded. "Yes. We keep going." The other question was Olson. Peter's distrust of the man had not abated, and though no one had said as much, he obviously represented a risk. For suicide, if nothing else. Since the train had stopped, he had barely moved from his place on the ground outside the engine, staring vacantly in the direction they'd come. From time to time, he would run his fingers through the loose dirt, scooping up a handful and letting it fall through his fingers. He seemed like a man who was weighing his options, none of them very good, and Peter suspected where his thoughts lay. Hollis pulled Peter aside as they were packing up the supplies. All the shotguns and the rifle now lay on one of the tarps beside the piles of ammo. They had elected to spend the night in the train. It was as safe a place as any, and set out on foot in the morning.
"What should we do about him?" Hollis asked quietly, tipping his head toward Olson.
Hollis was holding one of the pistols. Peter had the other.
"We can't just leave him here." I guess he comes.
He may not want to. Peter considered this for a moment.
Leave him be, he said finally. There's nothing we can do.
It was late afternoon. Caleb and Michael had gone around to the rear of the engine to siphon off water from the tanks with a hose they'd found in a closet in the engine's aft compartment. Peter turned to see Caleb examining a hinged panel about a meter square hanging off the underside of the train.
What's this? He asked Michael.
It's an access panel. It connects to a crawl space that runs underneath the floor.
Anything in there we can use?
Michael shrugged, busying himself with the hose.
I don't know. Have a look.
Caleb knelt and turned the handle.
It's stuck.
Peter, watching from 5 meters away, felt a prickling sensation along his skin. Something clenched inside him. All eyes.
High top.
The panel flew open, sending Caleb tumbling backward. A figure unfolded from inside the tube. Jude. Everyone reached for a weapon. Jude stumbled toward them, lifting a pistol. Half his face had been blasted away, revealing a broad smear of exposed meat and glistening bone. One of his eyes was gone, a dark hole. He seemed, in that elongated moment, a being of pure impossibility, half dead and half alive.
You fucking people, Jude snarled.
He fired just as Caleb, reaching for the pistol, stepped in front of him. The bullet caught the boy in the chest, spinning him around. In the same instant, Peter and Hollis found the triggers of their weapons, lighting up Jude's body in a crazy dance. They emptied both their guns before he toppled. Caleb was lying face up on the dirt, one hand clutched at the place where the bullet had entered. His chest rose and fell in shallow jerks. Alicia threw herself onto the ground beside him.
Caleb!
Blood was running through the boy's fingers. His eyes, pointed at the empty sky, were very moist.
Oh, shit, he said, blinking.
Sarah, do something!
Death had begun to ease across the boy's face.
Oh,
he said.
Oh.
Then something seemed to catch in his chest, and he was still. Sarah was crying. Everyone was crying. She got on the ground beside Alicia and touched her elbow.
He's dead, Leash.
Alicia shrugged her violently away.
Don't say that.
She pulled the boy's limp form to her chest.
Caleb, you listen to me. You open your eyes. You open your eyes right now.
Peter crouched beside her.
I promised him,
Alicia pleaded, hugging Caleb close.
I promised him.
I know you did.
It was all he could think to say.
We all know it.
It's all right.
Let go now.
Peter gently freed the body from her arms. Caleb's eyes were closed, his body motionless where it lay in the dust. He was still wearing the yellow sneakers. One of the laces had come untied. But the boy he was nowhere. Caleb was gone. For a long moment, nobody said anything. The only sounds were the birds and the wind in the tips of the grass, and Alicia's damp, half-choked breathing. Then, in a sudden burst, Alicia shot to her feet, snatched Jude's pistol from the ground, and strode to where Olson was sitting on the dirt. A furious look was in her eyes. The gun was huge, a long-barreled revolver. As Olson looked up, squinting at the dark form looming over him, she reared back and struck him across the face with the butt of the gun, knocking him flat to the ground, cocked the hammer with her thumb, and aimed the barrel at his head.
God damn you!
Leash!
Peter stepped toward her, his hands raised.
He didn't kill Caleb. Put the gun down.
We saw Jude die. We all saw it.
A trickle of blood was running from Olson's nose. He made no motion to defend himself or move away.
He was familiar.
Familiar? What does that mean? I'm sick of your double talk. Speak English, goddammit.
Olson swallowed, licking the blood from his lips.
It means
You can be one of them without being one of them.
Alicia's knuckles were white where she clutched the butt of the revolver. Peter knew she was going to fire. There seemed no stopping this. It was simply what was going to happen.
Go ahead and shoot if you want.
Olsen's face was impassive. His life meant nothing to him.
It doesn't matter. Babcock will come. You'll see.
The barrel had begun to waver, driven by the current of Alicia's rage.
Caleb mattered. He was worth more than your whole fucking haven. He never had anyone. I stood for him. I stood for him!
Alicia howled, a deep animal sound of pain, and then she pulled the trigger. But no shot came. The hammer fell on an empty chamber.
Fuck!
She squeezed again and again. The gun was empty.
Fuck, fuck, fuck!
Then she turned to Peter, the useless pistol dropping from her hand, leaned into his chest, and sobbed. In the morning, Olsen was gone. Tracks led away into the culvert. Peter didn't have to look to know which way he was headed.
Should we go look for him?
Sarah asked. They were standing by the empty train, assembling the last of their gear. Peter shook his head.
I don't think there's any point.
They gathered around the place where they had buried Caleb in the shade of a cottonwood. They'd marked the spot with a scrap of metal Michael had popped from the hull and etched with the tip of a screwdriver, then affixed to the trunk of the tree with sheet metal screws. Caleb Jones. High top. One of us. Everyone was there except Amy, who was standing apart in the tall grass. Beside Peter were Mouse and Theo. Mausami was leaning on a crutch Michael had fashioned from a length of pipe. Sarah had examined her wound and said she could travel as long as they didn't push it. Theo had slept straight through the night, awakening at dawn, and now seemed, if not better, then at least on the mend. Yet standing beside him, Peter could feel something missing in his brother. Something had changed, or broken, or been taken away. Something had been stolen from him in that cell. In the dream. With Babcock. But it was Alicia who worried him most of all. She was standing at the foot of the grave with Michael, a shotgun cradled across her chest, her face still swollen from crying. For a long time, the rest of the day and all that night, she had said almost nothing. Anyone else might have supposed she was simply grieving for Caleb, but Peter knew differently. She had loved the boy, and that was a part of it. They all had, and Caleb's absence felt not just strange, but wrong, as if a piece of them had been cut away. But what Peter saw now as he looked into Alicia's eyes was a deeper kind of pain. It was not her fault that Caleb was dead, and Peter had told her so. Still, she believed she had failed him. Killing Olsen would not have solved anything, though Peter couldn't help but think it might have helped. Perhaps that was why he hadn't tried harder. Tried at all, really, to take Jude's gun away from her. Peter realized he was waiting out of habit for his brother to speak, to issue the command that would set the day in motion. When he didn't, Peter hitched up his pack and spoke. Well, he said, his throat thick.
We should probably get going.
Use the daylight.
40 million smokes out there, Michael said glumly. What chance do we have on foot?
Amy stepped into the circle then.
He's wrong, she said.
For a moment, no one spoke. None of them seemed to know where to look. At Amy? At one another? A flurry of startled and amazed glances passing around the circle.
She can talk? Alicia said.
Peter stepped gingerly toward her. Amy's face seemed different to him now that he had heard her voice. It was as if she were suddenly present, fully among them.
What did you say?
Michael is wrong, the girl stated. Her voice was neither a woman's nor a child's, but something in between. She spoke flatly, without intonation, as if she were reading the words from a book.
There aren't 40 million.
Peter wanted to laugh or cry, he didn't know which. After everything, for her to speak now.
Amy, why didn't you say anything before?
I am sorry. I think I had forgotten how.
She was frowning inwardly, as if puzzling over this thought.
But now I have remembered.
Everyone fell silent again, gaping at her in astonishment.
So, if there aren't 40 million,
Michael ventured,
how many are there?
She lifted her eyes to them all.
12, said Amy.
Part 9. The Last Expeditionary. I am all the daughters of my father's house, and all the brothers, too. Shakespeare, 12th Night. Chapter 56. From the Journal of Sarah Fisher, The Book of Sarah, presented at the 3rd Global Conference on the North American Quarantine Period, Center for the Study of Human Cultures and Conflicts, University of New South Wales, Indo-Australian Republic, April 16th through 21st, 1003 AV. Excerpt begins.
And that was when we found the orchard. A welcome sight, since none of us has had anything like enough to eat since 3 days ago, when Hollis shot the deer. Now we are loaded up with apples. They're small and wormy, and if you eat too many of them all at once, you get cramps. But it's good to have a full belly again. We're bedding down tonight in a rusted metal shed that's full of old cars and stinks like pigeons. It seems we've lost the road for good now. But Peter says that if we continue walking straight east, we should hit Highway 15 in a day or so. The map we found at the gas station in Caliente is all we have to go by. Amy is talking a little bit more every day. It all still seems new to her, just to have someone to talk to. And sometimes she seems to struggle for the words, like she's reading a book in her mind and looking for the right ones. But I can tell that talking makes her happy. She likes to use our names a lot, even when it's clear who she's speaking to, which sounds funny, but by now we're all used to it, and even doing it ourselves. Yesterday she saw me stepping behind a bush and asked me what I was doing, and when I said, "I have to pee," she beamed like I'd just given her the best news in the world and said, too loudly, "I have to pee also, Sarah." Michael burst out laughing, but Amy didn't seem to mind. And when we were done with our business, she said, very politely, she is always polite, "I'd forgotten that was what it's called. Thank you for peeing with me, Sarah." Which isn't to say that we always understand her, because half the time we don't. Michael says it reminds him of talking to Auntie, only worse, because with Auntie, you always knew she was fooling with you. Amy doesn't appear to remember anything about where she comes from, except that it was a place with mountains, and that it snowed there, which could be Colorado, though we don't really know. She doesn't seem afraid of the virals at all, not even the ones like Babcock, who she calls the 12. When Peter asked her what she did in the ring to make him not kill Theo, Amy shrugged and said, as if this were nothing, "I asked him to please not do it. I didn't like that one," she said. "He's full of bad dreams. I thought it would be better to use my please and thank you." A viral? And she actually said please? But the thing that sticks in my mind most of all is what happened when Michael asked her how she'd known to blow the coupler. "A man named Gus told me," Amy said. "I never even knew that Gus was on the train, but Peter explained what had happened to Gus and Billy, that they'd been killed by the virals," and Amy said, nodding, "That was when." Peter got very quiet for a moment, staring at her. "What do you mean, that was when?" he said, and Amy answered, That was when he told me. After he'd fallen off the train. The virals didn't kill him. I think he broke his neck. But he was around for a little bit after. He was the one who put the bomb between the cars. He saw what was going to happen to the train and thought someone should know. Michael says there has to be some other explanation, that Gus must have said something to her earlier. But I can tell Peter believes her. And I know I do, too. Peter is more convinced than ever that the signal from Colorado is the key to all of this. And I agree. After what we saw in the Haven, I am beginning to think that Amy is the only hope we have, that any of us has. Day 31. A real town. The first since Caliente. We are spending the night in some kind of school, like the sanctuary, with the same little desks and rows in all the rooms. I was worried that it would have more slims in it, but we haven't found any. We've been taking the watch in shifts of two. I'm on second shift with Hollis, which I thought would be hard, sleeping a few hours and then waking up again, then trying to sleep a couple more before dawn. But Hollis makes the time pass easily. For a while we talked of home, and Hollis asked me what I miss the most, and the first thing that came to mind was soap, which made Hollis laugh. I said, "What's so funny?" And he said, "I thought you were going to say the lights, because I sure as hell miss those lights, Sarah." And I said, "What do you miss?" And he was quiet for a moment, and I thought he was going to say Arlo, but he didn't. He said, "The littles. Dora and the others. The sounds of their voices in the courtyard and the smell in the big room at night. Maybe it's this place. That kind of reminds me of them. But that's what I'm missing tonight. The littles."
Still no virals. Everybody's wondering how long our luck will hold out. Day 32. It looks like we're going to spend an extra night here. Everybody needs to rest. The big news is the store we found. Outdoor World. Full of all kinds of supplies we can use, including bows. The gun case was empty. We got knives and a hand axe and canteens and packs with frames and a pair of binoculars and a camp stove and fuel that we can use to boil water. Also maps and a compass and sleeping sacks and warm jackets. Now we all have new Gaps to wear and warm socks for our boots and thermal underwear, which we don't really need yet, but probably will soon. There was one slim in the store. We didn't see him until we were almost done, lying under the counter with the binoculars. It made us all feel a little bad that we'd been pulling stuff off the shelves and not even noticing he was there. I know Caleb would have made a joke about it, to cheer everyone up. I can't believe he's gone. Alicia and Hollis went hunting and came back with another deer, a yearling. I wish we could stay long enough to cure the meat, but Hollis thinks there'll be more where we're going. What he didn't say, because he didn't need to, was that if there's game, there's probably smokes, too. It's cold tonight. I think it must be fall. Day 33. Walking again. We're on Highway 15 now, headed north. The highway is quicked out, but at least we know we're going the right way. Lots of abandoned vehicles. They seem to come in clusters. You see a bunch of them together, and then nothing for a while. And then you hit a line of 20 or even more. We've stopped to rest by a river, hoping to make Parowan by late afternoon. Day 35. Still walking. Peter thinks we are covering about 25 kilometers a day. Exhausted. I am worried about Mouse. How can she keep this up? She's clearly showing now. Theo never leaves her side. It's suddenly hot again, scorching. At night there's lightning to the east, where the mountains are, but never any rain. Hollis got a jack on the bow, so that's what we're eating. Roast jack, split eight ways, plus a few leftover apples. Tomorrow we're going to try to look for a grocery
and see if there are any cans that are still okay to eat. Amy says that you can eat plenty of what's there if you have to. More 100-year-old food. Why no virals?
Day 36. We smelled the fires last night, and by morning we knew the forest was burning over the ridgeline to the east. We debated if we should turn around or wait, or try to go around somehow, but that would mean leaving the highway, which no one wants to do. We've decided to press on, and if the air gets worse, we'll have to make a decision. Day 36. Again. A mistake. The fires are close now. No way to outrun them. We have taken shelter in a garage off the highway. Peter isn't sure what town this is, or if there even is a town. We use the tarps and some nails and a hammer we found to cover the broken windows in the front. And now all we can do is wait and hope the wind shifts. The air is so thick, I can barely see when I'm writing.
Pages missing.
Day 38. We're past Richfield now, on Highway 70. In places it's washed away, but Hollis was right about the major roads, how they follow the passes. The fire came straight through here. There are dead animals everywhere, and the air smells like charred meat. Everyone thinks the sound we heard that night was the screams of virals caught in the fire. Day 39. The first dead virals. They were beneath a bridge, three of them huddled together. Peter thinks we haven't seen any before because they'd driven all the game up into the higher elevations. When the wind changed, they got trapped by the fire. Maybe it was just the way they looked, all burned up and their faces pressed to the ground. But I found myself feeling sorry for them. If I didn't know they were virals, I would have sworn they were human. And I know it could just as easily have been us lying dead there. I asked Amy, do you think they were afraid? And she said yes. She thought that they had been. We're going to stay an extra day in the next town we come to rest and scavenge supplies. Amy was right about the cans. As long as the seams are tight and it feels heavy in your hand, they're okay.
Pages missing.
Day 48. Moving east again, the mountains behind us. Hollis thinks we've seen the last game for a while. We are crossing a dry, open tableland, stitched by deep gullies. There are bones everywhere you look. Not just small game, but deer and antelope and sheep and something that resembles a cow, only larger, with a huge, knobby skull. Michael says they're buffalo. At half day, we stopped to rest by an outcrop of boulders and saw, scraped into the rocks, Darren loves Lexi forever. And Green River, SHS-16, Pirates kick ass. The first part everybody understood, but nobody knew what to make of the rest. It makes me feel a little sad. I can't quite say why. Maybe it was just that the words had been there so long with no one to read them. I wonder if Lexi loved Darren back. We got off the highway and are sheltering near the town of Emery. Nothing really left here, just foundations and a few sheds with rusted farm equipment full of mice. There's no pump we can find, but Peter says there's a river near here and tomorrow we'll go look for it. Stars everywhere. A beautiful night. Day 49. I have decided to marry Hollis Wilson. Day 52. Going south now from Crescent Junction on Highway 191. At least we think it's 191. We actually walked straight past the turnoff, at least 5 clicks, and had to double back. There's not much of a road to follow, which was why we missed it in the first place. I asked Peter why we had to get off the 70, and he said we're too far north for where we're going. Sooner or later, we'll have to head south, so it might as well be now. Hollis and I have decided not to tell anyone about what's happened. It's funny how when I made up my mind about him,
I realized I had been thinking it for a long time without knowing it. I wish all the time I could kiss him again, but everyone's around, or else we're on watch. I still feel kind of guilty about the other night. Also, he really needs a bath. So do I. No towns at all. Peter doesn't think we'll hit one till Moab. We are spending the night in a shallow cave, really just a recess with an overhang, though it's better than nothing. The rocks here are all a kind of orange-pink color. Very lovely and strange. Day 53. Today was the day we found the farmstead. At first we thought it was just a ruin, like all the others we've seen. But as we got closer, we saw it was in much better shape. A cluster of wood-frame houses, with barns and outbuildings, and paddocks for animals. Two of the houses are empty, but one of them, the largest, looks like someone was actually living here not so long ago. The table in the kitchen was actually set with places and cups. There are curtains in the windows, clothing folded in the drawers, furniture and pots and pans and books on the shelves. In the barn we found an old car, covered in dust. The shelves lined with jugs of lantern fuel, empty jars for canning, tools. There's what looks like a graveyard, too. Four plots marked with circles of stones. Michael said we should dig one up to see who's down there, but nobody took the suggestion seriously. We found the wellhead, but the pump was rusted tight. It took three of us to free it. But once we did, the water that came out was cold and clear, the best we've had in a long while. There's a pump in the kitchen that Hollis is still trying to free up, and a wood stove for cooking. In the basement, we found more shelves stacked with cans of beans and squash and corn. The seal's still good. We still have the tins we scavenged in Green River, plus some of the smoked venison and a bit of lard we saved. Our first real meal in weeks. Peter says there's a river not far, and tomorrow we're going to go look for it. We're all bedding down in the biggest house, using mattresses we dragged from upstairs and set around the fireplace. Peter believes the place has been abandoned at least 10 years, but probably not more than 20. Who lived here? How did they survive? The place has a haunted feeling to it, more than any of the towns we've seen. It's as if whoever lived here went out one day, expecting to be back for supper, and simply never returned. Day 54. We are staying an extra day. Theo is insistent, says Mouse can't keep up this kind of pace. But Peter says we have to leave soon if we want to make it to Colorado before the snow. Snow. I hadn't thought about that. Day 56. Still at the farmstead. We decided to stay a few more days, though Peter's antsy and wants to get moving. He and Theo actually argued about this. I think...
Indecipherable. Pages missing.
Day 59. We are leaving in the morning, but Theo and Mouse are staying behind. I think everyone knew this was coming. They made the announcement right after supper. Peter objected, but in the end there was nothing he could say to change Theo's mind. They have shelter. There's plenty of small game around, plus the cans in the basement. They can ride out the winter here and have the baby.
We'll see you in the spring, brother, Theo said. Just don't forget to stop in on your way back from whatever it is you find.
I'm supposed to be on watch in a few hours, and I really should be sleeping. I think Mouse and Theo are doing the right thing. Even Peter has to know it. But it's sad to be leaving them behind. I think it's making us all think about Caleb. Alicia, especially, who clammed up completely after Mouse and Theo gave their news, and has yet to say a word to anyone. I think everyone's remembering those graves in the yard, wondering if we'll ever see Mouse and Theo again. I wish Hollis were awake. I told myself I wouldn't cry. Oh, damn. Damn.
Day 60. Traveling again. Theo was right about one thing. Without Mouse, we are making better time. The six of us got to Moab well before dusk. There's nothing here. The river has washed everything away. A huge wall of debris is blocking the way. Trees and houses and cars and old tires and every kind of thing, filling the narrow canyon where the town once was. We've sheltered for the night in one of the few remaining structures, up in the hills. A complete derelict, just the framing and a patchy roof over our heads. We might just as well be out in the open, and I doubt anyone's going to get much sleep tonight. Tomorrow, we're going to walk up the ridge, try to find a way through to the other side.
Pages missing.
Day 64. We found another animal carcass today. Some kind of large cat. It was hanging in the limbs of a tree, like the others. The body was too rotted to tell, but everyone is thinking it was a viral that killed it. Day 65. Still in the La Salle Mountains, heading east. The sky has turned from white to blue, the color of autumn. There's a damp, delicious smell to everything. The leaves are coming down, and there's frost at night, and in the morning, a heavy, silver mist hugs the hills. I don't think I've ever seen anything so lovely. Day 66. Last night, Amy had another nightmare. We were sleeping out in the open again, under the tarps. I had just come off watch with Hollis, and was prying my boots off when I heard her mumbling in her sleep. I was thinking maybe I should wake her up, when suddenly she sat bolt upright. She was all wrapped up in her bag, only her face showing. She looked at me for a long moment, her eyes unfocused, like she didn't know who I was. "He's dying," she said. "He keeps on dying and can't stop." "Who's dying?" I said, "Amy." "Who?" "The man," she said. "The man is dying." "What man?" I asked her. But then she lay back down and was fast asleep again. Sometimes I wonder if we are heading towards something terrible, more terrible than any of us can imagine. Day 67. Today we came to a rusted sign by the road that said, "Paradox, population 2,387. "I think we're here," Peter said, and showed us all on the map. We are in Colorado.
Chapter 57. The mountains declined at last to a broad valley, wide in the autumn sunlight, beneath an azure dome of sky. The grass was tall and parched, the limbs of the trees barren, or else dotted with a few remaining leaves, the stragglers bleached to the color of bone. They lifted in the breeze like waving hands, rustling like old paper. The ground was dry, but in the culverts water ran freely. They filled their canteens with it, cold as ice against their teeth. Winter was in the air. They were six now. They moved across the empty land like visitors to a forgotten world, a world without memory, stilled in time. Here and there the shell of a farmhouse, the skull-like grill of a rusted truck. No sound but the wind and the creak of the crickets, flicking through the grass as they walked. The terrain was easy, but this wouldn't last. A distant white shape, painted across a far horizon, told a story of mountains to come. They rested for the night in a barn by a river. Old tack hung on the walls, buckets for milking, lengths of chains. An old tractor sat on flattened tires. The house was gone, collapsed into its foundation, its walls improbably folded one on top of another like the flaps of a box, not so much destroyed as packed away. They divvied the cans they'd found and sat on the floor to eat the contents cold. Through the ragged tears in the roof they could see stars, and then as the night drew down, the moon, ringed by scudding clouds. Peter took first watch with Michael. By the time Hollis and Sarah relieved them, the stars were gone, the moon no more than a region of paleness in the cloud-thickened sky.
He slept, dreaming of nothing, and when he awoke in the morning he saw that it had snowed in the night. By mid-morning the air had warmed again. The snow had melted away. On the map the next town was named Placerville. 8 days had passed since they'd seen the body of the cat in the trees. The feeling that something was following them had dissipated over the long days of walking, the silent, star-strewn nights. The farmstead was a distant memory. The haven, and all that had occurred there, seemed like years ago. They were tracing a river now. Peter thought it was the Dolores, or the San Miguel. The road was long gone, absorbed by the grass, the wash of earth and time. They marched in silence, two rows of three. What were they looking for? What would they find? The journey had acquired a meaning of its own, intrinsic. To move. To keep moving. The thought of stopping, of reaching the end, seemed beyond Peter's power to imagine. Amy was walking beside him, her back sloped forward against the heft of her pack, her sleeping sack and winter jacket lashed to the bottom of the frame. She was dressed, like all of them, in clothing scavenged at Outdoor World. A pair of Gaps cinched to her hips and on her upper body, a loose-fitting blouse of red and white checks, the sleeves unsnapped and flapping around her wrists. On her feet, a pair of leather sneakers. Her head was bare. She had given up the glasses long ago. She kept her eyes forward, squinting against the brightness. In the days since they'd left the farmstead, a shift had occurred. Subtle but unmistakable. Like the river, she was leading them now. Their job was simply to follow. With each passing day, the feeling grew stronger. Peter thought, as he often did, of the message Michael had shown him, that long-ago night in the lighthouse. Its words formed a backbeat to the rhythm of his walking, each footfall carrying him forward into a world he didn't know, into the hidden heart of the past. To the place where Amy came from. If you found her, bring her here. If you found her, bring her here. He had discovered in the days since they'd left the farmstead that he did not miss Theo as he'd thought he would. As with the haven and all that had happened before it, even the colony itself, thoughts of his brother seemed to have fallen away. Subsumed like the grassy road by the project of simply moving forward. At first, that night when Theo and Mouse had called them all together and announced their decision, Peter had been angry. He had not shown this, or hoped he hadn't. Even in the midst of it, he knew this anger was irrational. It was obvious that Mouse could not continue. Part of him simply didn't want his brother to leave him again so soon. But Theo had the facts on his side. And in the end, Peter could only agree. But he had also come to see, over the days, a deeper truth behind his brother's decision. His path and Theo's had been destined to diverge again, because their cause was not the same. Theo did not seem to doubt their story of Amy, or at least he had said nothing to make Peter think so. He had absorbed Peter's explanation, fantastic as it was, with no more or less skepticism than it deserved. Yet Peter could detect in his brother's compliance a feeling of detachment. Amy meant nothing to him, or meant very little. If anything, he seemed a little afraid of her. It was clear that he had come as far as he had only because that's where the group was headed. At the first opportunity, and under the circumstances of Mausami's pregnancy, he had quickly given this up. Selfishly, Peter would have wished for more, if only for Theo to have expressed some regret, however small, at their separation. But he hadn't done this. The morning of their departure, as the six of them had walked away from the farmhouse, Peter had turned to see his brother and Mausami watching them. A small thing, but it had seemed important to Peter that Theo remain where he was, standing on the porch until the six of them were out of sight. But when Peter looked again, his brother was gone. Only Mausami was there. When the sun was high, they stopped to rest. They could see the line of mountains plainly now, a rugged bulk against the eastern skyline, the peaks dolloped in white. The day had grown warm again, enough to make them sweat.
But up high, where they were going, winter had already arrived. "More snow up there," Hollis said. He was sitting beside Peter on a fallen log, its rotted bark blackened with dampness. No one had spoken a word in at least an hour. The others were scattered around, all except Alicia, who had gone ahead to scout the terrain. Hollis knifed open a can and began to spoon the contents to his mouth, some kind of shredded meat. A bit got caught in the coarse tangle of his beard. He wiped it away, washed the last of his meal down with a long, throat-pumping drink of water, and passed the can to Peter. Peter took the can and ate. Sarah, sitting across from him with her back against a tree, was writing in her book. She paused, her eyes focused intently at what she'd written. Her pencil was just a nub, almost too short to hold. While Peter watched, she drew her blade from her belt, scraped it across the tip, and then resumed her patient scribbling. "What are you writing about?" Sarah shrugged, hooking a stray strand of hair behind her ear. "The snow. What we ate, where we slept." She lifted her face to the trees, squinting into the sunlight descending through the sodden branches. "How beautiful it is here." He felt himself smile. How long had it been since he'd smiled? "I guess it is, isn't it?" A new feeling seemed to have come over Sarah since they'd left the farmstead, Peter thought. An unhurried calm. It was as if she had decided something and, in so doing, had moved more deeply into herself, into a state beyond worry or fear. He felt a flicker of regret. Watching her now, he realized how foolish he'd been. Her hair was long and matted, her face and bare arms streaked with grime. Her nails were blackened with crescents of dirt. And yet she'd never looked more radiant. As if all that she had seen had become a part of her, infusing her with a glowing stillness. It wasn't a small thing to love a person. That was the gift she had offered him, had always offered him. And yet he had refused it. Sarah met his eyes then. She cocked her head in puzzlement. "What?" He shook his head, embarrassed. "Nothing." "You were staring." Sarah shifted her gaze to Hollis. The corners of her mouth lifted in a quick flash of a smile. Just a moment, but Peter felt it keenly, the invisible line of connection between the two of them. Of course. How could he have been so blind? "It wasn't anything," he managed. "Just, you looked happy sitting there. It surprised me, is all." Alicia emerged from the brush. Balancing her rifle against a tree, she retrieved a can from the pile of packs and bladed it open, frowning at the contents. "Peaches," she groaned. "Why do I always get peaches?" She took a place on the log and began to spear the soft yellow fruit from the can straight into her mouth. "What's down there?" Peter asked. Juice was dripping down her chin. She gestured with her blade in the direction she had come. "About half a click east, the river narrows and turns south. There's hills on either side, heavy cover, lots of high points." The peaches gone, she drained the can into her mouth and cast it aside, wiping her hands on her gaps. "The middle of the day like this, we're probably okay. But we shouldn't hang around too long." Michael was sitting a few meters away on the damp ground, his back braced against a log. The days of walking had made him leaner, harder. His chin now sported a wisp of pale beard. A shotgun was resting across his lap, his finger close to the trigger. "No sign in what, 7 days?" He spoke with his eyes closed, his face tipped toward the sun. He was wearing only a t-shirt. His jacket was tied around his waist. 8, Alicia corrected. "That doesn't mean we should let our guard down." "I'm just saying." He opened his eyes and turned toward Alicia, shrugging. "A lot of things could have killed that cat. Maybe it died of old age." Alicia gave a laugh. "Sounds good to me," she said. Amy was standing by herself at the edge of the glade. She was always drifting off like this. For a while, this habit had made Peter worry, but she never went very far, and by now they were all accustomed to it. He rose and went to her. "Amy, you should eat something. We're moving on soon." For a moment, the girl said nothing. Her eyes were directed toward the mountains, rising in the sunlight beyond the river and the grassy fields beyond. "I remember the snow," she said, "lying down in it. How cold it was." She looked at him, squinting. "We're close, aren't we?" Peter nodded. "A few days, I think." "Tell you right," Amy said. "Yes, tell you right." She turned away again. Peter saw her shiver, though the sun was warm. "Will it snow again?" she asked. "Hollis thinks so." Amy nodded, satisfied. Her face had filled with a warm light. The memory was a happy one. "I would like to lie down in it again. To make snow angels." She often spoke like this, in vague riddles. Yet something felt different this time. It was as if the past were rising up before her eyes, stepping into view like a deer from the brush. Even to move would scare it away. "What are snow angels?" "You move your arms and legs in the snow," she explained. "Like the ones in heaven. Like the ghost Jacob Marley." Peter was aware that the others were listening now. A single strand of black hair pushed over her eyes in the wind. Watching her, he felt himself transported back through the months to that night in the infirmary when Amy had washed his wound. He wanted to ask her, "How did you know, Amy? How did you know my mother misses me? And how much I miss her?" "Because I never told her, Amy. She was dying. And I never told her how much I would miss her when she was gone." "Who's Jacob Marley?" he asked. Her brow furrowed with a sudden grief. "He wore the chains he forged in life," she said, and shook her head. "It was such a sad story." They followed the river into the afternoon. They were in the foothills now, leaving the plateau behind. The land began to rise and thicken with trees, naked, twig-like aspens and huge ancient pines, their trunks wide as houses, towering over their heads. Beneath their vast canopies, the ground was open and shaded, pillowed with needles. The air was cold with the dampness of the river. They moved, as always, without speaking, scanning the trees. All eyes. There was no Placerville. It was easy to see what had occurred. The narrow valley, the river carving through it. In spring, when the snowpack melted, it would be a raging torrent. Like Moab, the town had washed away. They sheltered that night at the river's edge, stretching the tarp between a pair of trees to fashion a roof and laying their sleeping bags in the soft dirt. Peter was on the third shift with Michael. They took their positions. The night was still and cold, filled with the sound of the river. Standing at his post, trying to keep motionless despite the chill, Peter thought of Sarah, and the feeling he had detected between her and Hollis in that private gaze, and realized that he was honestly happy for the two of them. He'd had his chance after all, and Hollis obviously loved her, as she deserved to be loved. Hollis had told him as much, he realized, that night at Milagro when Sarah was taken. "Peter, you of all people should know I have to go." Not just the words themselves, but the look in his eyes. An absolute fearlessness. He'd given it up right then. He'd given it up for Sarah. The sky was just paling when Alicia stepped from the shelter and walked toward him. "So," she said, and gave a loose-jawed yawn.
"Still here?"
He nodded. "Still here." Each night without sign made him wonder how much longer their luck could hold. But he never thought about this for long. It seemed dangerous, like daring fate, to to question their good fortune. Alicia said, "Turn around. I have to go." Facing away, he heard Alicia unbuckle her trousers and lower herself to a squat. 10 meters upstream, Michael was resting on the ground with his back against a boulder. Peter realized he was fast asleep.
"So what do you make of this business?" Alicia asked. "Ghosts and angels and all that."
"Your guess is as good as mine."
"Peter," she scolded,
"I don't believe that for a second."
A moment passed, then, "Okay, you can turn around now."
He faced her again. Alicia was cinching her belt.
"You're the reason we're here, after all," she said.
"I thought Amy was."
Alicia turned her eyes away, toward the trees on the far side of the river. She let a silent moment pass.
"We've been friends as long as I can remember. Nothing can change that. So what I'm going to tell you is between us. Understood?"
Peter nodded.
"The night before we left, the two of us were in the trailer outside the lockup. You asked me what I saw when I looked at Amy. I don't think I ever answered, and probably I didn't know at the time. But I'll tell you my answer now. What I see is you."
She was regarding him closely, wearing an expression that was almost pained. Peter fumbled for a response.
"I don't understand."
"Yes, you do.
You may not know it, but you do. You never talk about your father or the long rides.
I've never pressed.
But that doesn't mean I didn't know what they meant to you. You've been waiting for something like Amy to come along your whole life. You can call it destiny if you want, or fate. Auntie would probably call it the hand of God. Believe me, I've heard those speeches too. I don't think it matters what name you give it. It is what it is. So you ask me why we're here, and I'll say, sure, we're here because of Amy. But she's only half the reason. The funny thing is, everybody knows it but you."
Peter didn't know what to say. Ever since Amy had come into his life, he had felt himself caught in a strong current, and that this current was pulling him toward something, something he had to find. Every step along the way had told him so. But it was also true that each of them had played a part, and a great deal had simply come down to luck.
"I don't know, Leash. It could have been anyone that day at the mall. It could have been you. Or Theo."
She dismissed this with a wave.
"You give your brother too much credit, but you always did. And where is he now? Don't get me wrong, I think he did the right thing. Mouse was in no shape to travel, and I said so from the start. But that's not the only reason he stayed behind."
She shrugged.
"I'm only saying this because you might need to hear it. This is your long ride, Peter. Whatever's up that mountain, it's yours to find. Whatever else happens, I hope you get that chance."
Another silence fell. Something about the way she was speaking disturbed him. It was as if these words were final ones. As if she were saying goodbye.
"You think they're all right?" he asked.
"Theo and Mouse."
"I couldn't say. I hope so."
"You know," he said, and cleared his throat, "I think Hollis and Sarah
are together."
She gave a quiet laugh.
"And here I was, thinking you hadn't noticed.
You should tell them, you know. Personally, it will be a load off everyone's mind." He was completely astounded.
"Everyone knows?"
"Peter." She met his eye with a correcting frown.
"This is exactly what I'm talking about. It's all well and good to save the human race. You could say I'm in favor. But you might want to pay a little more attention to what's right in front of you."
"I thought I was."
"That's what you thought. We're just people. I don't know what's up that mountain, but I do know that much. We live, we die.
Somewhere along the way, if we're lucky, we may find someone to help lighten the load. You should tell them it's okay. They're waiting to hear from you. It still confounded him how slow he'd been to detect what was happening with Sarah and Hollis. Perhaps, he thought, it was something he hadn't wanted to see. Looking at Alicia now, her hair shining in the morning light, he found himself recalling their night together on the roof of the power station, the two of them talking about pairing, having littles. That strange and amazing night when Alicia had given him the gift of stars. At the time, just the idea of it, of living a normal life, or what passed for one, had seemed as distant and impossible as the stars themselves. Now here they were, more than 1,000 kilometers from home, a home they would probably never see again. The same people they had always been, but also not the same. Because something had happened. Love was among them. That's what Alicia was telling him now. That's what she had been trying to tell him that night on the roof of the power station, in that last easy hour before everything had happened. That what they did for love. Not just Sarah and Hollis. All of them. Leash, he began. But she shook her head, cutting him off. Her face was suddenly flustered. Behind her, Sarah and Hollis were emerging from the shelter into the morning. Like I said, we're all here because of you, Alicia said. Me more than anyone. Now are you going to wake up the circuit or am I? They broke camp. By the time they were moving downriver, the sun had lifted over the crest of the valley, filling the branches of the trees with a vaporous light. It was almost half day when Alicia, at the head of the line, abruptly halted. She raised a hand to silence everyone. Leash, Michael called from the rear. Why are we stopping?
Quiet!
She was sniffing the air. Peter smelled it too. A strange and powerful odor, stinging his nostrils. Behind him, Sarah whispered, What is that? Hollis pointed with his rifle over their heads. Look! Suspended from the limbs above their heads were dozens of long strands of small white objects, bunched like fruit. What the hell is that? But Alicia was looking at the ground now, anxiously scanning the carpeted earth beneath their feet. She dropped to a knee and brushed the heavy covering of dead leaves aside. Oh, shit. Peter heard the groan of the dropping weight. Before he could speak, the net had swallowed them. They were rising, lifting through the air, all of them yelling and tumbling, their bodies caught in its weave. It reached the apex of its ascent, everything cradled.